time now to have a discussion from the floor. So I obviously want your hands up, please, and the mics will get round to you. And well, let's go ahead, gentlemen at the front here.
Hi, Dwayne Farrell from AGNI. I suppose I have a question quite specifically for Jane. If Minister McCann was still with us, I might have addressed some of this to the Minister as well. As we know, protection from discrimination is fundamental to enjoying human rights. And I was disappointed that Minister McCann didn't include in the speech the fact that there is a programme for government commitment to extend age discrimination legislation. Age is the only ground here in Northern Ireland on which it is still legal to discriminate against people. That means, and we speak to older people all the time who are perhaps being denied life-saving treatments. There was a paper last year from Queen's University that indicated older people are not being put into cancer treatments that could save their lives. So my question to Jane is, in the sort of existing framework of international commitments and obligations that the UK government has signed up to, is there anything that helps us here in Northern Ireland fill that gap on the age ground that people can be protected from discrimination?
Jane.
Oh, you'd like me to answer immediately. Yes. Well, age is not in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But other grounds is there, and of course other grounds, nor is LGBTI in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is a latecomer, and in the UN, just to tell you, there is a compulsory retirement age of 62. And just to tell you all about myself, at the end of March next year, I will be 62. And I think I can still function, but clearly the United Nations doesn't. And you can't imagine how... Well, I'm sure I'll be able to do something when I have to leave, but you can't imagine how that sort of feels if you've, this is the end of your life as you've known it for X number of years. As a result of this, and of course as a result of really significant discrimination, I mean, that's not an enormous problem, with regard to, say, healthcare, with regard to decision-making, so on and so forth, a big lobby has generated itself to have another convention elaborated. It is not going as fast as it could go because there is resistance because the view is the standards are there, and certainly the standards are there. If you look at the treaties, non-discrimination, but not specifically on the basis of age, is obviously covered, and the UK government obviously has obligations by virtue of its ratification of all of the treaties. It's a big ratifier. So clearly it is there, but what we've seen, and we saw it in the context of the disability movement also, that was the same. The same remarks were made. There is no need for another treaty on discrimination or another treaty providing a rights regime which is specific or which benefits this group of people because they can use the other regime. Which is always what is said, and it's going to be expensive, it's going to be time-consuming, they will want a treaty body, etc., etc. From my point of view, these sorts of movements which support the creation of standards, support the creation of mechanisms, really bring the issue onto the table, and this is the case with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. There we've seen, despite the arguments that treaty was not needed, that now you have, in an event such as this, in the Human Rights Council, you have signing, you have things for the hard of hearing, the brilliant Palais de Nation has been modified so persons with disabilities can get into it. So it really does make a difference. So yes, the standards are there. No, there's not any specificity. But there is a movement to create, to elaborate further standards, and we have to think about what that means and think about what the arguments against that sort of those standards and against further mechanisms means.
Well, can there be any arguments against them? I mean, the only argument would be limited resources, I guess.
Well, the argument is always the same, that And we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have the covenants, civil and political rights, economic, social and cultural rights, and that is what we have. And we then have other treaties, because you'll see, for example, we have the Race Convention, the first treaty and treaty with a treaty body. Then you have the Women's Convention. The Women's Convention elaborated because, despite lots and lots of legal obligations, extensive discrimination against women continued to exist. We have the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and these were born out of movements of people who were specifically who were noticing the discrimination that people faced, and also that human rights was interpreted in a particular historical, in a particularly specific way. So it was, you looked at the interpretation against the background of why the UN was established, why the rights were elaborated, and you interpreted them against that background. You didn't, for example, interpret the right to life to take into account the specific issues that, or the specific things that have to be done to ensure a person with disabilities enjoys the right to life. You didn't take into account the specific things that have to be done to ensure an older woman, for example, a woman of 80, has to have done in order to enjoy her right to life. So as a result of that, the further standards are created. And the anxiety is, are we fragmenting? And then weakening? Is it going to be very expensive because we'll have another mechanism? But they're the... I don't think they're probably the issues that are going on. Why is it when you look at these standards, you will say, okay, enough now. Older persons can be fitted into everything else. And this is not to say, I was involved with the development of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and its optional protocol, and I was speaking in the ad hoc committee of the General Assembly at one point, and I was really struck. Someone took the floor and said, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you don't look in the mirror and say, I'm experiencing my rights today as a woman or as a member of a minority or as a member of a racial group or as a person with a disability or as an older person. You experience them together. And so you experience them together, and yes, you could possibly have another little element in the jigsaw puzzle to have a full set of rights. But then there will be others, of course, and of course it's a movement, and the movement creates the sensitivity, changes the stereotypical attitudes. It isn't immediate, of course, but it's very, very important to me.
Patrick, just a second. Do you still have the microphone? No. Just bring it back down again for us. I just want to, you know, your perspective on that. I mean, in terms of a developing movement and in terms of, you know, the other areas of human rights which may require new movements, where you feel that movement is.
I think Jane's answered the question quite clearly. Yeah. That those protections aren't there in the current existing instruments. The open-ended working group on conventional rights of older person is a huge hope for us all, that we can actually begin to change those ageist attitudes and protect people in the ways that they need protected. So, thank you, Jane.
Thank you. Patrick.
Patrick, you're nice, the Northern Ireland Council for Ethnic Minority. I have a question to Jane. It's in relation to the leadership of our government. I think, as you are aware, you know, in this forum in particular, economic, social, and cultural rights are so vital to the life of the people. There's also built into, you know, part of, you know, the Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland. It is one of the key parts. But unfortunately, our politicians, every time when we raise the issue about economic, social rights, then they will argue, you just, you know, take away my democratic, you know, mandate as elected politician because you restricted, you know, our budgeting or others. So what will be, you know, what we could learn from other jurisdictions to deal with, you know, that issue about economic social rights? The second question is about the legacy of the past and also the competing rights between different groups. Can we also have another example from the UN we can learn how we deal with, you know, those issues? Thank you.
So evaluating competing rights, Jane, some international experience perhaps.
Well, they don't compete, actually. Civil and political rights, economic, social and cultural rights, it's not a competition because the elements required from states that have made themselves, and some haven't, of course, the United States being a very good example, they are not party to treaties which establish economic, social and cultural rights, because I think there's some misconception that things are different with regard to economic, social and cultural rights than civil and political
but Jim, rights. But Alan gave us the example of the meeting that he was at where, you know, I have the right to walk down any street in this city which I want to. Someone else says, hold on, I have the right for you not to do that because you offend me. So even in this small context, there are areas where rights absolutely do compete.
Well, I wouldn't say walking down the street necessarily is a right. I mean, I'm just talking of the, you know,
tell
the
that to the Orange Order.
but I mean, in terms of human rights. I mean, I was just thinking in terms of economic, social, and cultural rights: the right to food, the right to adequate housing, the right to work, these sorts of things. The right not to be, as opposed to the right to be free from torture, the right not to suffer, be executed arbitrarily, and so on and so forth. In those contexts, the rights you were talking of were the economic, social, and cultural rights, which wouldn't be the right to free movement and so on and so forth. But I think in that context, there's a lack of understanding that to fulfil civil and political rights, you need to spend a lot of money to do it properly. So if you're going to ensure that people are not tortured, you really have to put a lot, you really have to ensure that your institutions exist, that your courts behave appropriately, you don't have corrupt judges and so on and so forth, and this costs money. And similarly, the right to adequate housing costs money. So I think that's where we still have a failure to understand that there's positive and negative obligations with regard to both sets of rights, which are not sets of rights, they are indivisible. But things are moving, and I've been very interested to see the states which traditionally wouldn't be very interested in economic, social and cultural rights being quite happy to talk about the right to water and sanitation, so for example, which is an extraordinary right when you think about it. It is part of the right to life, obviously, but the right to water and sanitation, regarded as non-justiciable perhaps, but regarded as a right. The legacy of the past, I think the best you can do is to look at the work of Farida Shaheed and Pablo de Greff. They have been particularly investigating the legacy of the past. Pablo de Greff, predominantly in Latin America. He did a very interesting visit to Uruguay. And there you can see the sort of compilation of the practices. And I think this meeting, the discussions that took place with Farida last year are very, very important, and I would recommend that you read carefully the report. It's not an area of my... I mean, I don't specialise in this. I've got... but it is an area that I've decided now I want to move into and look at very carefully. Particularly coming also from a country where there is a big legacy of the past, and seeing how that's been dealt with in terms of the apology and so on and so forth is something that I believe valuable to look at and to see what could be not replicated but could be built on in other contexts.
Monica, just in terms of human rights as against available resources, I mean, you will have known when that campaign started about access. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, this is going to cost us a fortune. Mm-hmm. We can't afford to do this.
That's right. And mostly it was the disabled, the business community who did that. But, you know, they used grants for other things that nobody talked about. For example, grant on when fair employment came in. There was everybody needed it, so it was fine. But because we lived in an isolated community, it wasn't important. We have no power, and I think power is not talked about very often because it's so powerful. And I think we have no power. We have some now, but it's still too little too late.
And just, Alan, on the issue of competing rights, I mean, you have been to other places as you work with WAVE. You've looked at how other post-conflict societies are dealing with it. I mean, the competing rights are very much a reality here still, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And, I mean, I suppose for me, you know, I don't even know if really, and this might be the wrong place to say this at a human rights conference, but I don't know if human rights language is actually the way to conduct those conversations, because I think that we have to reach agreements with people, and if you've got two sets of competing rights and both of those people are demanding that their rights are absolutely respected, I don't know who adjudicates on that, and that's why you have the standoffs that we have here. So I think it's much better, and I've had conversations. I mean, I remember having conversations not that long ago actually with some flag protesters who were coming down and demanding their right about flying their own cultural symbols, etc., etc. And I think in a divided society like ours that we have to reach agreement. We have to have discussions and dialogues, and so therefore it's not just about rights, it's also about the twin of human rights, which is about responsibilities, and I think that our society needs to grow up and get a sense of that.
Well, the people who are deciding, I suppose, are the people that Jennifer McCann's just left and just gone back to, politicians holding these talks, and I mean, we know how tortured that is.
Absolutely, and you know, in this society as well, I don't think that I think I'll get widespread agreement around the room. I mean, our politicians don't always lead by example. I mean, Jennifer McCann, you know, used the example of Teabuck, Together Building United Community. And whilst I would be, you know, at one level a critic of that, I don't think it went far enough. I think it lacked imagination. But the biggest, criticism I would have of it is actually who wrote it. The fact that it was written by the DUP and Sinn Féin. And if you kind of just listen to the radio in the last week or two, the antics of those two parties haven't exactly endeared me to United Community.
Okay. Paddy, you had a question.
Thanks very much. Paddy Kelly from the Children's Law Centre. I wanted to pick up initially on Duane's point about age discrimination, and for those who may not know in the room why age discrimination legislation has not been brought forward in this political mandate is because some of the political parties do not think that children and young people should be included within the scope of that legislation, which means that a third of the population are being denied their rights to be protected against age discrimination. And I think Carla very eloquently gave voice this morning to the need to protect children's rights and to respect children and young people as rights holders. And the denial of her rights is only a small reflection of the multiplicity of the denial of children's rights in this jurisdiction. I wanted to pick up by way of a question, and my question is not just for the panel, it's for everybody in this room. And I wanted to pick up on Monica's, which I think, if I'm not misinterpreting you, Monica, is a sense of your frustration when you highlighted the absence of MLAs and councillors and, in fact, other decision makers in this room today. This conference was targeted at those people. There was wide circulation invitations went out. And I think their absence is an indictment on them. In this room, if you look at the different constituencies that we represent, we are representing the majority of people in this society. Older people, younger people, people with disability. And yet, I am concerned that less than a mile across the road, people are making decisions in relation to these talks about our future and how dignity and rights will be protected going forward. They are also making decisions about how the undelivered rights were protected in the Good Friday Agreement, how they are going to be taken forward, things like the Bill of Rights, dealing with the past. And yet, I am concerned that they are not listening to our constituencies. And my challenge, or my question, and I suppose I am a bit frustrated by their absence today, my question is, how can we ensure that what comes out of these talks does protect the dignity and rights of all the people that we in this room are working for and are trying to give voice to?
Boy, that's a big one.
Very easy.
I don't know if anyone else in the room would like to make a contribution or response, not obviously not a response to it, but just to add to it. I mean, I'm not sure we have anyone here who can answer that question, Paddy, but I'll put it to Monica to start with. What can you do to ensure that your voice is being heard?
Be a bit louder. and people be more belligerent. I think we've sat not silently, but we sat quietly, and I think we need to up the ante. Just but as how, other
in
people
practice,
are.
What does that mean? What is that, going and demonstrating at the steps of Stormont?
Yeah, I mean, we would demonstrate because we could demonstrate now because we have enough people, but we didn't have enough people to demonstrate. And I'm only talking about disabled people because that's the only expert I am. Hmm. But I think that would be very powerful. Might not do any good, but it could be very powerful.
Just wondering, it's not a bad day. Maybe we could hold this afternoon session at the steps of Stormont. Alan, yes, sir, in a second, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think for myself, I mean, I don't know that you need a huge lot of people to actually get your voice across as the first thing. I think in Northern Ireland, you know, because it's such a small society, such a small country, I think our politicians are very accessible. I mean, I know that certainly at the Wave Trauma Centre, we've been lobbying for the last 2-3 years on a pension for very seriously disabled people that were disabled as a result of the Troubles, and we've been doing all the rounds up at Stormont, and I've got a good ear from our politicians. But it comes back to this whole notion for me around the fact that we're such a divided society and that people see even the conflict through very different lens, and so therefore trying to reach agreement is particularly difficult. And if I can just give you an example of our pension, which we have, as I say, had widespread support from the political parties, it has now come down to there's 357 people who were very seriously disabled through the Troubles, very seriously disabled. And there are 10 people who were disabled as a consequence of their own actions. And that has come down to,
of that 350, 10.
And above 10 people in addition to the 357. And Sinn Féin absolutely want them included because as far as they go, they don't want to leave anybody behind. There was a conflict that existed in Northern Ireland. Their people fought in that conflict, and so they should be regarded in much the same way as British soldiers or RUC officers should be regarded. And that's quite a moral response to that. The DUP, for the same token, are saying absolutely no way will we ever put our signature to a pension that will reward perpetrators any sort of compensation, you know, recompense for what they've been through. Again, a very moral argument. At the end of the day, you know, these people planted bombs. Why would you want to reward people with that? But, you know, the greater morality for me is the 357 people who are just there, that have lived at the mercy of the state, really since the 1970s and the 1980s, that get compensation at the time, but they weren't expected to live as long as they have, and they're now facing old age, and they're living in poverty. And our politicians are up at the hill, and I'm hoping, I actually spoke to Jennifer just before she left today, to say, look, is this pension in the talks? It was absolutely part of the House and Sullivan talks, but our politicians, in much the same way as the Bill of Rights and all the other things, you know, they seem to park it, they can't agree it. So it's not about getting your voice heard, it's about our politicians and the failure to agree. And this society, for me, needs to grow up.
Jane, are these typical arguments, or are we really so different from everywhere else?
I don't know. This is...
We can't even decide who's a victim in this society.
Well, I think possibly you're very articulate in terms of placing the issues on the table, but perhaps there are many societies that have similar issues, and you can look at Latin American states, African states, let us wait until, if there's ever a resolution in the Middle East. But the articulate way of laying out the issues is very, very interesting. On power, I always think, you know, if you had power, would you want to give it away? And I think that's the basic issue. If you have it, and most of my work has been with relation to women's human rights, and you see it all the time. And I was interested, we've only had one woman speak from the floor. If you were the group with the power, the men, are you going to be that interested in giving it up? And that, I think, is one of the bottom lines that we're looking at. This may sound like a trivial answer, but I think there are ways of making your voice louder by using these international human rights mechanisms, by bringing these issues to certainly the Universal Periodic Review, for example, where you have that bilateral discussion between states as well as the multilateral discussion of a particular human rights situation or how the country is going. As I said, states are very, very keen on having, you know, their political capital retained, and in the multilateral system you see that all the time. I think on business and human rights, as I say, the 2,000 people at the Forum on Business and Human Rights is showing us that there is a growing understanding that the costs in terms of your reputation, if you behave in a certain way as a business, are becoming more known. And you know about, I mean, Zara really got a hit after the Bangladesh factory fire. And I know many young people who will never buy Nike training shoes. So I think this is an area where we have to push. And that's the other thing. We talk about the state-individual relationship. There are others out there, and we see it with these just revolting groups in Syria and Iraq. And we do see more and more the business community, other non-state actors, and that's where we need to penetrate, because they often they have a lot of power, and their power is financial, and we need to make them understand that their reputation is extremely important in terms of their continuing their financial enterprise.
Paddy, yeah, go ahead. Yes, is this on the same topic, or are we moving on? Oh, good, great. Yeah, just because I wanted to get a few more comments on that.
My name is Margaret Foley. I agree with everything Paddy Kelly said, except I think we're probably more representative here of civil society than the people who are in Stormont at the moment, probably. And I just ever wondered what happened to the Civic Forum, because that was supposed to be the place where these groupings here could have a voice and would be listened to by the politicians.
Yeah.
But that's just...
Well, it wasn't, was it? It kind of...
But it just never happened. But it was set up under the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes. But it happened and it met, and everyone lost interest in it.
But maybe we could ask for that to be regenerated. It's just a suggestion.
Go ahead, Al.
I was on it along with Dwayne Farrell. What happened to it? It was literally just mothballed. I mean, I think that we were simply given a thank you for our time, and it was never brought back out again. I don't know whether the Civic Forum was ever seen as a threat by our politicians. You know, I don't know if that was the case, but I certainly think it's a wonderful idea for civic discussion, for negotiation. We could have discussed lots of things, or as we did when we had the Civic Forum. But unfortunately, after the last collapse, before it was all reconvened again, it hasn't seen the light of day. Or Dwayne wants to say anything.
It was never revived. Yeah. There's a gentleman over there, please.
Hiya, Desi Donnelly from PPR. It's just on the same point, and it's really touching on a lot of what Monica has said, and around the whole issue, because I think it's a bigger issue, and the issues that I think we've been in existence since 2006, and we have seen, although we weren't starting from a very high bar, certainly, you know, diminishing amounts of levels of transparency and accountability within the executive departments and statutory bodies as well. Just a couple short examples is that in 2009, the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights examined the British government, UK government, and made a series of concrete recommendations about Northern Ireland, you know, that looked at issues like equality impact assessments for urban regenerations, looked at high rates of suicide, also looked at religious inequality in housing, and made some very specific recommendations. Now, we've helped groups then to write to OFMDFM on three occasions since then to ask on updates and what the executive is doing about it. They haven't even dignified that with a response to date. Other issues around that, if anyone sticks a Freedom of Information request in OFMDFM, you've got a very, very long wait on that as well. Just yesterday, a couple of people involved, Bertie, who opened the conference today on the video, asked a question of a city council official at a public event about the issue he was talking about employment for long-term unemployed people through City's Council's budget, to which the official responded that they couldn't answer a question from him because he currently had a Freedom of Information request submitted to the council. Now, although that's an anecdote, what you're seeing is that level of non-transparency and a lack of accountability filtering right down from our political leadership right down to your frontline civil servants sometimes. And I think that's an extremely worrying development here. And I'm interested in the debate about, well, what do we do about that? You know, not in abstract terms, because I don't think what cuts it is just simple articulation of human rights standards, but there needs to be tactics, and people, communities, and need to be able to actually use their rights and not wait for the rights to be granted to them. Mm-hmm. And one sort of, I'm losing the run of myself here, but. I just think we need to look beyond the people in this room having a voice through something like a civic forum, because it's not necessarily about the people in this room. It's about the people like Bertie and about the people who Ellen works with on a daily basis, and making sure that politicians are sensitive to their rights and their needs. And our role essentially is to try to open that up a bit more. And I think that's part of the problem that us, as if you want to call us a sector, is that sometimes we're too satisfied when we're given a voice, and we're not necessarily putting the bar at where disabled people on the ground or people who've experienced trauma on the ground, they're the ones who actually need the voice.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can get a question out of that, but it was a very useful comment. Yes, gentleman here.
Colin Flynn, chair of CareFriend, the oldest LGBT organisation in Northern Ireland. You've had questions from two women tonight, today. Great. Now you're going to get one older gay man. For a change, pride in both age and my sexual orientation. It's in relation to the competition between religion and rights, equality, human rights. Respect and dignity for older, for LGBT people, basically in Northern Ireland. We have this big problem here where, I'm not going to go into the equal marriage thing, but I'm going to into the recognition of the equal marriage, that if you get married in London in the morning and you arrive in Belfast Airport in the afternoon, suddenly you aren't what you intended to be. You become a civil partner. So you're not married. That's one thing. Second thing is about the adoption rights here. While those have gone through the courts, they haven't been implemented because of the tardiness of the Department of Health. So those two things are still outstanding. Those are rights which affect dignity of each individual gay or lesbian person.
Do you think adoption is a human right?
I think the right to adopt is. The right to adopt is. It's a matter then for the authorities to decide whether that person's suitable for adoption. The right for the child's rights are also being affected in that they don't have, say, perhaps languishing or remaining in a home, a public home, rather than in a private place where they would get much more nurture and love.
Right. Is there a question?
The question is about the competing rights. Oh, sorry, about religion. Religion is Christian religion, is the sort of right which seems to trump a lot of these other rights which go to the very dignity of the individual lesbian gay person.
Is that a widely noted phenomenon?
Well, when I spoke about the work with regard to LGBTI now and sexual orientation in the United Nations. And it's all I can say is this is an enormous process. And certainly the issues that you're talking about, adoption, marriage, and so on and so forth, haven't reached the table at the international level, because what we need, we need to have a consensus, and we're moving slowly, a consensus on the issue that people who, any person, irrespective of sexuality, is to be treated without violence, without serious discrimination, and essentially without fear of death. So we're at that beginning stage. So it will take some time before we get to more specific areas of equality and non-discrimination you're talking about, not the right to adoption or the right to marriage. So it's a very contested area, and it's a contested area because of what is described as these are alien concepts and not cultural concepts that we're familiar with. They are constructs introduced by the West. They are, of course, in contradistinction to our religious beliefs and so on and so forth. But it's remarkable that you see progress, and I spoke of the judgment of this Botswanan judge. His judgment was to do with whether you could could register an organisation which was advocating for the elimination of violence, discrimination, and so on and so forth against gay people. And he looked at the objective of the organisation, which was essentially the welfare of people, and he said, well, I see nothing wrong here. Everybody's welfare is of interest. So he's able to look at it and be very imaginative, and I don't think it will be appealed, which is a wonderful thing. It was a case against the government. So, I mean, to work in human rights at the international level or the national level really requires a very optimistic person. And you can't be a person who says everything is bad and nothing is going to get better. And this is one of the areas which is extremely difficult, but that you can have the Secretary General of the United Nations from Korea saying again and again and again there should be no discrimination against people on the basis of their sexual orientation and gender identity makes a big difference. And that you can have in a country like India, the Bollywood actors at the head of a campaign to deal with the right, you know, the equality with regard to persons of irrespective of sexual orientation and gender identity, for me is an enormous. And I mean, you just couldn't have thought about it 5 years ago. It really required leadership. So things change, not fast. I've got an example. As I told you, I'm very old. In the 80s, I was asked to write a monograph for the UN on violence against women in the family. And I had a bit in there, not very much, I think it was a paragraph, on female genital mutilation. And that was cut out. So that was interesting. 10 years later, in 1998, I was asked. By then, I'd joined the United Nations, and so had to calm down a bit. I was asked by the Executive Office of the Secretary General to write a draft speech for Kofi Annan, who was then the Secretary General, on female genital mutilation. So things can change, but we need people like yourselves, and I think getting people like yourselves to get more people like yourselves and it's the imagination. Get the vision of the Universal Declaration to take their imagination and get them to realise that things can change.
Do you want a quick word, Alan?
Yeah, just a very quick word. I mean, I suppose it really comes back to the theme of the conference, you know, getting human rights back to basics, you know, recognising equality, dignity. I mean, absolutely, I'm sure there's nobody in this room would disagree that people should not be discriminated against on grounds of their sexual orientation, race, religion, political thought, or whatever. And I have often said, you know, and I mean, I serve on the Human Rights Commission, and you know, sometimes human rights can get lost in the whole law and the legal aspects of it, where the normal people that I would work with, you know, wouldn't have a notion. I mean, they'd be lost in those types of conversations. So we absolutely, absolutely have to reconnect with those people in a way that they can understand what the rights are and also the responsibilities. But sometimes, you know, and I suppose this is why, I mean, the law is important and we have to, it has to go down that road. And I mean, if you take Colin's point around religion and human rights and how sometimes they collide, and in relation to our own case around the Asher's cake thing that we've been talking about a lot here, maybe it is up for the courts to actually decide on that, to give a steer. But I don't know. I think that I would be quite uneasy if people, for example, in churches and stuff like that, were forced in this situation, which was contrary to their beliefs. And I think we also have to recognise that as well. And that's difficult. That's complex.
Okay. On that note, Jane, Monica, and Alan, thank you very much for your contributions. Thank you, too, from the floor.